Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project here on the Nerd Party Network. Every 2 weeks we discuss two further films in the A24 filmography, and in between we try and bring you interviews with the talent involved. In this episode we're turning our attention to the lesser known films Skin and Cher, and joining me as ever on this odyssey is Dallas King. Welcome back, Dallas.
Glad to be back. How are you doing?
Yeah, another week in lockdown. There's not even any sort of exciting A24 news to report. We were just saying just before we started, we should have been at the Edinburgh Film Festival today, kind of kicking off. I was kind of hopeful for something like First Cow potentially showing. So instead, we've got nothing, just probably rewatching endless things on Netflix and catching up on cooking shows we've probably watched 100 times.
Absolutely. I mean, no, not even any A24 news of, you know, some filmmaker they like who is shot an entire film during lockdown or something like that. You know, that's going to be the next thing over the next couple of months, I think, with filmmakers so bored they decide to make a film entirely shot within their own home using an iPhone and stuff like that, and A24 will love it.
There we go. I look forward to that A24 joint. But obviously we'll kind of dive into sort of our two films today, and they are both Skin and Cher. So Skin is up first. A destitute young man, played by Jamie Bell, raised by racist skinheads and notorious among white supremacists, turns his back on his hatred and violence to transform his life with the help of a black activist and a woman he loves. So based on the true story of Brian Widener and from the Oscar-winning short movie, also called Skin, from writer-director Guy Nativ. Dallas, when did you first see this film?
I saw it about 2 days ago. Nice and fresh in the mind for discussing here. I knew a little bit about it. I think I sort of was aware of it when it sort of was released, but I don't think it ever really screened in Aberdeen. I think it maybe got a small release in the UK, but I never got around to seeing it, and then I've just sort of held off until it was time to appear on the project. And it was quite a surprising film. I think it was, you know, Jamie Bell was fantastic in it, and I wasn't actually really aware it was a true story kind of until the end. I hadn't watched any of the trailers or anything like that, so I wasn't familiar with the story. I just thought it was one of those like American History X type films about white supremacy and someone trying to leave it, so I wasn't really aware of the whole sort of true story element, which of course I sort of dived into post film anyway. But yeah, quite an interesting and different take on it for A24.
Yeah, so I caught this one last year, talking of Edinburgh Film Festival, I caught this one there. And it was one of those ones I kind of was maybe expecting something kind of relatively generic, you know, bad person kind of gets reformed and sort of that journey. And what I think kind of is interesting about the film, and I suppose we'll probably dive into that a little bit more next, is sort of this... A film like this is always going to provoke some kind of reaction. You can look at this film, perhaps you sit back and go, okay, this is interesting, it shows that people can be redeemed. Or there can be the discourse where it's like, well, actually, this is a film that's out there, but why should we want to give representation to these people, you know, white supremacists, reformed or not? They do not deserve the accolades. We should be giving attention to perhaps maybe some of his victims. You know, there's a lot of different takes that people are going to have about this film without even sort of discussing the film itself. And I think the film is really solid. I think it's had strong performances. Yeah, it's a pretty generic sort of true life story, but it was one that kind of caught me through the whole way. I think what's interesting has just been the debate and discussion, and I actually think this has been a breakout A24 film. Obviously it wasn't A24 here in the UK, but you know, you think of some A24 films, you know, think of something like Midsommar, everyone talks about it, it's on Amazon Prime, Hereditary gets added today, people have a broad discussion. I've seen Skin kicking around in more places than I have nearly a lot of kind of A24 films. I see it sort of available to buy for £5-7 in places like Morrison's, our version of probably Walmart, to be able to pick up there. It's on Amazon Prime, it's kind of kicking around on Sky for a while. It's one of those films that seems to have broken out, and there's definitely seems to be a kind of audience, it seems, for this film, despite the kind of discourse in seeing a film like this. So I think there's a whole lot of interesting things about this film that aren't in the film, which kind of interests me.
Yeah, no, I was not aware it was available in Morrison's. I mean, the supermarkets actually seem to be upping their game recently in terms of DVD and Blu-ray releases. I was in, I think it was Sainsbury's the other day, and they had Lighthouse, they had Parasite, and they had Snowpiercer, which apparently was in the top 20, which is, you know, a great thing to see. The fact it's, you know, finally, you know, about, is it about 6 or 7 years after it was meant to be released, it's finally got a DVD release in the UK and it's in the top 20. That's always good. But yeah, it's an interesting one because, you know, the market in the UK is, well, up until recently, one would argue that there maybe isn't really a huge white supremacist problem in the UK. Maybe not so much now, you know, because it's quite clear that there probably is. I mean, I think the marketing of it in the US versus UK is probably slightly different in the fact that Jamie Bell is a sort of homegrown talent, sort of shot to fame with Billy Elliot, and it's probably fair to say maybe has struggled to find a leading role that has sort of matched that. You know, he's been great in sort of films like Hal and Foe stuff, but he's never really sort of reached that same sort of level, and his performance in here is fantastic. It's one of the best things about it, because like you say, I think if you were asked, if you're a film fan and you were asked to write, you know, just a very basic spec script of a story of a white supremacist who wants to change his life, turn his back on the whole thing and get a new life, you probably would be able to plot it out almost beat for beat exactly what happens. But I mean, you know, watching it, it kept reminding me of American History X, you know, because that's a film where it tries to humanize and give, you know, not to tar all white supremacists with the same brush, but it's like to say, you know, not all Nazis are bad, whatever. It's like, you know, in this one, you know, Edward Norton is an incredibly bad person. He does something which is truly horrific, and the sound effect of teeth scraping on curb will forever be with me. But he does, towards the end of the film, try to turn it all around. You know, unfortunately it doesn't work out well for anyone involved, but you know, he tries. And so it's like you say, it's going to be interesting to see. There will be people who probably will write the film off immediately before even seeing it, because, you know, it's like, well, why would I want to watch something like that, you know? But it does try to show it from both sides. It shows sort of why and how he probably got into it in the first place, with the sort of the younger kid sort of coming up the ranks as well. That was probably him sort of 5-10 years before that. And then, you know, you can see the moral conflict he's got within himself, and, you know, the chance to get out and get a better life. You know, it's something he wants to, but it shows just how difficult, I think that's one of the good things about this film, it shows just how difficult it can be to turn your back on something like that, especially when, you know, you've got all the tattoos basically saying, you know, you are a white supremacist. And I would potentially like to have seen almost a bit more of that aspect of it, about the clearly horrific pain that he goes through to get rid of, basically, you know, wiping the slate almost completely clean by removing all these tattoos and stuff like that. I thought it was maybe going to be a bit more about that side of it, but still a very, very interesting film and very powerful, I thought.
Yeah, I definitely think there's an interesting second kind of film to be made there, or sort of a documentary perhaps about that sort of procedure of getting all those kind of tattoos removed and sort of acclimatizing to the real world. I mean, what I find so interesting about the film is the tattoos, obviously it causes an issue for Brian in this film about sort of being able to break free, you know, how people react to them. But even though you know, I'm there as an audience member, and it's challenging my perceptions of, like, it's very difficult for me to look past them a little bit. And, you know, when he's being kind of really, you know, nice and, you know, being affectionate around the kids and so on, you're like, you know, oh God, like, look at those tattoos, that's horrible. And, you know, it makes your kind of skin curl a little bit in a way that, you know, even some of the best monster movies would kind of struggle to do. I thought it was really interesting, the reactions it provoked from me. You know, that's obviously the politics and everything kind of speak for itself, but I was baffled by how I kind of responded to the tattoos.
Yeah, no, the tattoos is, I mean, it's excellent sort of makeup work. And I was reading on, I think it was IMDb, that said apparently at one point they ran out of money for the sort of makeup and stuff like that. So Jamie Bell would actually have to wear those tattoos for a couple of days at a time before they could be sort of washed off and replaced. So he actually really got into character and felt what people thought of him, you know, just the snap judgments of people seeing him with all these tattoos. Apparently the crew would not want to eat with him and stuff like that, because I think they were sort of genuinely sort of weirded out by it. So, you know, I guess it helped him probably get in the mindset. But I did think this film was going to pull a bit of a fast one at the end, because, you know, you see him going through all this tattoo removal, and then of course they've got that shot of him going up to his girlfriend's house at the end, you know, back to the camera, and you're thinking, oh, is this going to do a Nolan? Is this going to like cut out just before you get to see, you know, what's happened to him? I thought it was going to do that, but I'm not going to spoil about whether it does or not.
Yeah, before we kind of dive into any of our further thoughts, I actually got the chance to speak with Academy Award winner Guy Nativ last year, who kind of talked to me about the interesting process of bringing this to the screen and the making of the film. So here's Guy. One of the films that we're kind of going to focus on today is your short film Skin. What was your inspiration to write this film? Because as you mentioned, you're an Israeli filmmaker, and this is a very American story. What was your inspiration to write this film, and how did this come into being?
So I was long distance. I had a long distance relationship with my now wife, Jamie Newman, and it was Tel Aviv and Los Angeles. She's an American actress, and she was living here. And I, at a certain point, after like 2-3 years in, after I proposed, I knew that I'm going to move to the U.S. So I was looking for my first U.S. feature, you know, because I prepared my landing in a way. And I was sitting in a coffee shop in Tel Aviv, and I, saw an article in the paper that had Brian Widener, the Skin protagonist, face fully tattooed, from being fully tattooed transferred into a clean face. And the headline was the only skinhead who made it alive to the other side, or something like that. And the subtext was like, it took him 66 surgeries and 2.5 years of excruciating pain to become normal again. And I was reading the article, and I was blown away by the story and by the change, which is so rare with these kind of people. And I called my wife, and I sent her the article, the link, and she was blown away too. And through MSNBC, that made a documentary about them, we got their emails, and I wrote them a very long email about, you know, myself and my Holocaust survivor grandparents, and why me, why I should tell the story. And after 2 months, they got back to me, and we Skype, and we spoke over the phone, and you know, they told us, if you're really serious, why don't you come and visit us, see us in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that's what we did, you know. And my grandfather, who is my, you know, used to be my, he's now, he passed away, but he used to be my hero and my inspiration. He was very anti-Germany and whatever, you know, considered German after the war. And, you know, it took him years and years to kind of like accept that there's a new generation of Germans. There's new generations of Polish people. And he taught us acceptance and patience and dialogue. And this is coming from a man who lost his entire family in the Holocaust, his entire tribe, which is my family too. So, you know, he taught me a lot, and I saw Brian Widener and Daryl Monjekin's story as something that, inspire me. And my grandfather gave me the green light. He said it's a very important story to tell to the world. So we went to Brian's house in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we met with them. And it was an amazing meeting because I'm the first Israeli Jew that he met in his life. He's the first ex-neo-Nazi skinhead I met. So it's kind of like, it was insane. But after this long weekend of talking and spilling everything on the table, you know, just spilling his guts, and he signed the life rights on a napkin, and I started writing Skin, the feature.
I'd read that you had people avoiding investing in the film at the start because they didn't believe that white supremacy was a problem in America. So, I mean, this is only a few years ago, but, you know, in the past 24 hours alone, we've had a white supremacy shooting in America. What was it like working and writing on Skin and seeing the rise in Trump to the presidency and white supremacy becoming more and more prevalent?
Well, first of all, it's true. No one in Hollywood wanted to put their money in a skinhead redemption story. People told me it's not really a thing in the States. It's, you know, there's no really racism here. Like, you know, it's maybe like 12 people in the Midwest. It's not a real thing. And I told them, I told producers, look, I've done the research. It's much bigger and threatening than you think. It's almost terrorism. It's domestic terrorism. And they looked at me and they said, look, Hillary is about to become president. Obama is in power. We don't see a real threat to our country. And you know, it's like they didn't get it. They were living in their bubble, you know. So coming from a very troubled country and knowing how the right wing, you know, took the power in Israel, I almost saw it coming, that Trump going to be elected and it's the rise of the right wing and the extreme fascism will come to its worst in America. But nobody wants to give me the money, obviously. And I decided with my wife to do something that I did in Israel. Every film in Israel was a short. Every feature that I did was a short before. Because that's the way I kind of prepare myself for the long run. Like it's a sprint before the marathon. So we put all our retirement money to do a short. Shalom Maimon, a good friend of mine from Israel, called me one day and said, hey, I have a great idea for a short. Here's the concept. And he gave me the entire concept, and I told him, oh my God, this is fucking brilliant. And we wrote it over a weekend together, and Skin the Short came to life. We brought Daniel McDonald, who's our neighbor here, and, you know, we kind of shot it for 5 days. It was my first U.S. kind of like cinematic work. And we edited it with friends from Israel. The entire post-production was done in Israel. And we sent it out to the world. And once we sent it out to the world, to producers, Trump got elected. Charlottesville happened. And then the synagogue massacre in the East Coast happened. So it's like, you know, everything happened. And the short started, you know, we sent it to actors. So suddenly Jamie Bell saw it. And, you know, and three producers, Oren Moverman, Celine Recrae, and Trudy Styler, who's Sting's wife, saw the short, read the script for the feature, and said, we're in, because it's very, very important to tell this story. So, you know, it's the... Everything happened in the same year or 2 years that made everything in the zeitgeist, but also crazy, you know. So there were two kind of producers. One that says, wow, it's really in the zeitgeist. It's really timely, but we're afraid to do that because it's too crazy to do that right now. And the other ones that said, and these are the producers that came on board, that said, not only it's important, not only we're gonna shoot it this year, we need to do it for the world to see. So yeah, that's the evolution of Skin the Short and Skin the Feature.
The opening scene of Skin would eventually be mirrored in your feature, and it's such a striking image of just the son having his head shaved by his father. What is it about that image that struck you so strongly that it became used twice?
Well, you know, during the research, I understood that the concept of the storytelling of Skin the Short and Skin the Feature, that it's all about education. It's all about education, because if you look at this guy who shot yesterday in Dallas, in Texas, in El Paso, he was a young kid who probably needed to be approached while he was 15 and 16. He's a troubled kid who was brainwashed. And I seeing Brian Widener joining the gang at the age of 14, it was also someone who was a street kid and was collected by those radicals, by those fascists, and they taught him hate. So I understood that everything starts from action, from us as kids, as teenagers. And I thought that it's very symbolic to start the movie with this grown-up hand carving this boy into a monster, and then cut to seeing Brian with tattoos on his face when he's like 28. But also, it's the concept of the short is, you know, coming from the Bible. I'm not a religious person, but it's a smart sentence that says, our fathers ate bad fruit, and the children's teeth will be rotten, which means whatever you teach your kid gonna end up biting you in the ass. So, you know, it's kind of a reverse violence. So I think that both Skin the Short and Skin the Feature starts with kids, and it ends up with kids.
When I kind of saw the Skin short film for the first time, I was really struck by the ending, that we often see people in films where it tackles racism and racist. We often see people being the victims of racism, but we very rarely see the consequences for the perpetrator. But we do in this film, and it's a striking ending. How did that evolve, and was there any sort of debate about it, and what was some of the reaction to it?
Two things happened. One, I read an article in a newspaper about a skinhead father, kind of a fascist skinhead father, who taught his son how to shoot Mexicans in the border in Arizona. And he brainwashed his son. He basically, his 14-year-old son got like hate and everything. It was really something that, you know, he taught him, and the son became a hate machine. And then one night, the father came home at 2 a.m. drunk, and the son saw his shadow and thought he's an African-American, you know, kind of burglar, intruder. So he took his father's gun, exactly like the father told him, and he shot his father in the head. And that striked me, you know, in a way that it's what you teach your kids, as I told you before. The other thing that happened is that Daryl Lamont Jenkins, the African-American activist, told me, look, because he was a consultant on the short and on the feature, he told me, look, in cinema, you always see African-Americans or black people being bashed, killed, humiliated, suffering, you know, the entire, you never see a revenge in movies. And he said, why don't you just write a cool revenge that has a message, but a smart one, and put it as the end, like, you know, make the revenge happen. And that's what we did, because he gave us the green light. Now, how were the reactions? It's funny, because African American in states are saying, "Fuck yeah, that's a great, you know, great revenge." White people are like more feel unease about the whole situation. I think it's white guilt in a way. But the best thing that happened to us is that two nights before the Oscar, that we had a party at ICM, my agency, and Spike Lee was one of the, you know, people that arrived to the party, and he came to me and to my people and said, "I voted for you." So once Spike Lee gave us this green light, for me it was like, all right, I'm done. It's all good.
I love that you cast Danielle McDonald in this that you'd mentioned earlier, in the short and the feature. And it's so great to almost see that her career has exploded since Patty Cakes. That film has really struck me, and I love her and everything. What drew you towards her, casting her in both the short and the feature?
Well, she's an extremely talented person. I adore her. I adored her in Patty Cakes. I think she's a real person, not the Hollywood cliche of what it means to be, you know, coming from those places. She looks real. She's very similar to the real Julie. And she has warmth, intelligence, she's sexy, and she's a real woman. And you know, seeing her and Jamie Bell in a coffee shop before we, and just their chemistry, I was so blown away by that. And I adore this actress, and I think she's amazing.
Absolutely. Really,
she's just so authentic and real, and she could do everything, you know?
Definitely.
She's just a brilliant actress, yeah.
How did you feel to be nominated for the Oscar, for the short film? And then what's it like to actually go on and win it? Because you'd mentioned earlier you'd previously been nominated, but this time you go that one step further. What's that moment like when you hear your name and film on the biggest of stages winning an award like that?
Well, I, you know, it's surreal. It's like you, probably like you, you watch the Oscars every year, right?
Yeah.
You watch it live. I woke up like you at 4 a.m. every night, imagining myself maybe even in the crowd, just to be there. But, you know, we were not the favorite to win. Okay, let's go back a little bit. I was in the shortlist for the Oscars with Strangers, my second short. And we got it, my friend and I, Ernest Moore and I, we directed together and wrote it together. And we got to the 10, but didn't get into the 5, and it was a heartbreak. Because the film won Sundance, went to many festivals, and Fox Searchlight bought it in 2008. So we were shortlisted. So this time I said to myself, I'm not going to even think beyond being in the 10. Because look, it's not an easy movie. It's an extreme movie. It's a gruesome movie. It's brutal. It has a kind of a controversial end, right? And, you know, the voter, the Academy voter is older and white, and, you know, you never know. They usually pick the mainstream movies, right? So we were not a favorite. There was another Canadian movie that was favorite to win. We were second in all the papers. So, you know, we just enjoyed the moment, and getting into the 5 was already like, wow, you know. When they called our names, it was, and I always say, like, people to ask me, how does it feel? It's almost like your bar mitzvah, your wedding, and the birth of your child in the same time. It's beyond insane. It's like surreal. Until today, I'm sitting now in my bedroom right now, and on my right, I have my Oscar. It's even surreal to look at it. You know, it's just surreal. It's like, and in this year, so we had this year of like, we had a short. we shot the feature. We got into Toronto with a feature, to Berlin, and then Tribeca. We won the Oscar with the short, and now we crossed the 100 film festivals with a short film. So it went to 100 film festival. And before the Oscar, we didn't even get to Sundance. We were denied by Sundance, Cannes, and Berlin with the short. You never know.
Absolutely. I mean, it's unique to have your short and feature both come out in the same year. Was that a kind of demanding time for you as like a writer director to have sort of two of these sort of on the go at the same time? Often you hear about the short gets made, it becomes popular, or maybe it wins the Academy Award, and then a few years later the feature comes along. What was it like sort of doing one after the other?
It's surreal. It's very confusing, but also very powerful. It's very, very powerful. I think it's, you know, it's two of your kids, two kids. One is a short, you know, kind of a baby skin, and the other is a feature skin. So it's a, and also it's like a different, it's a different approach to raise them, you know. So yeah, I just it's the whole year and the birth of my baby and everything, you know. It's an Alma, you know, my baby girl is 10 months now. So it's a year that I will never forget in my entire life.
Your feature film differs from Skin to an extent. Was always your aim to go a different road and tell a different story?
You know, I thought about making a scene from the feature Skin to show kind of like way of how do I deal with American actors, how do I, you know, with American production, the whole thing. But then Shalon Maimon, my friend, came with this concept for the short, and I was blown away. So it kind of reshuffled my plans. But originally it was supposed to be a scene from Skin the Short, their feature.
All your features have been short films first, and this feels like a really unique and exciting kind of process. Why has this been such a successful model for you?
Making shorts into features is really like preparing for a marathon by running sprints. You know, it's every filmmaker, there's a gap between every feature that you make, because it takes so long to make features. So, you know, you have sometimes 4 years between feature and another one, till you get the cast, the money, the whole thing. So instead of basically writing, I feel that sometimes you need to refresh this muscle. Work on this muscle. It's almost like going to the gym. You know, it's like you work on a muscle and you don't want this muscle to be soft. And it's the directing muscle. It's the going, being on set and working with actors muscle, which I think it's very important. First. Second, I think that when you direct a feature, if you can, try the concept, try stuff. You know, in a short, when you have creative freedom, full creative freedom, you can try stuff. You can play with stuff. You can experiment stuff, and then it could always, like, you know, it's almost like a lab when you test stuff before you go and do the big project. So that's, for me, it gives me a lot of security. It gives me a lot of, you know, it's almost like, for actors, it's like a reading before doing a play or a movie. So it was always successful for me in terms of like, oh, this is the DNA, and now I extend it to an hour and a half. I love short films. I love like the medium of telling a story in 15, 20 minutes, sometimes 10. And when it works amazingly. But not every feature can be short, and not every short can be feature.
I think Jamie Bell was inspired casting for this film. Why was it for you that a British actor was the perfect person for the role as a, you know, white American supremacist?
The funny thing is that it was Israeli, British, Australian, and American telling a story about what's going on here. But, you know, racism is global. And I feel that racism exists in England, and it exists in Israel, and it exists in Hungary, Greece, France, Russia, all over the world. So for me, it doesn't matter if the actor, I mean, as long as he can do American accent perfectly, it doesn't matter where he come from. I think that Jamie Bell is a brilliant actor, one of the best actors in the world. And I think that it was for him opportunity to stretch his abilities from what he'd done before that. And I think that working with him and Danielle and Vera Farmiga and everyone was just a school for me. It was almost like, you know, I learned so much from working with these exquisite actors. And Jamie, the process that he went through, I mean, taking somebody who everybody knows as Billy Elliot, who's the opposite of Brian Wyder in Skin, and turn him into a monster was a real fascinating process for me. Oren Moverman, and I'm giving him the credit, he brought Jamie Bell. He met him in a coffee shop, and they spoke about life, about, you know, about next projects and the whole thing. And he called me and he said, look, I met with Jamie Bell. I saw a man, not a kid anymore. And I went to Jamie to Virginia, and I met him, and I saw a man with a lot of depth and sensitivity. So, you know, when you're portraying a monster, it was easy. It was really important for me that it won't be the cliche of a just a monster. This is a tormented monster with feelings, with depth, with emotions, with a lot of stuff. And Jamie, for me, could bring that to the film.
And did you work together on sort of the physical and mental transformation to get Jamie into sort of that mindset and into that character?
Well, you know, I think that I told Jamie what I want and need for the film, and Jamie told me, okay, let me have my process. And he did a phenomenal job gaining weight, going into this mindset of this dark mindset. He went to Brian Wyder. He stayed with him for a month, and, you know, he really became this person. And then he did this test with tattoos with Stevie Battles, the genius tattoo artist, not tattoo artist, but makeup artist who made the tattoos. And he just, when he came to set for the first day, it was mind-blowing. The guy was Brian Wyder. So I trust my actors that they do their due diligence and their homework. I fine-tune them while working with him. But we had a lot of discussions before he went into this journey, and I told him whatever stuff that I need.
One of my favorite things when I watched this film for the first time, I went into it blind a few months ago when I got the chance to see it at the Edinburgh Film Festival. All I knew was the poster, Jamie Bell, hey, I'm sold, was that it blended family drama with body horror really well. What was it like for you sort of crafting this film and bringing together a lot of different elements to create something really exciting?
Where did you see the film?
At the Edinburgh Film Festival.
Oh, cool. What was was it like? Can you ask the question again?
Yeah, so what was it like to... I think the film... What I love about the film is that it blends this family drama and tension with body horror. What was it like combining sort of a lot of these different elements together to make something as exciting as Skin?
You know, the whole work on this movie was very complicated because... It's a low budget movie. We made it for peanuts, and you had dogfights, kids, tattoos, gunshots. It was shot in -5 in upstate New York in Kingston. It was in the middle of the winter. You had a lot of extras. You know, the opening scene had like something like 200 people. And I had only 23 days of shooting it, so it wasn't easy task for me, and I became ill in the middle of shooting it. I had pneumonia for 3 days. I was on antibiotics, and I directed from my bed. They basically brought a bed into set, and I directed the movie. But I gave everything I got, and you know my good friend from Israel gave me this frame, and in this frame, when I came to the States, she gave me a present, the frame, and in the frame was a sentence, and the sentence said, "You were once wild here, don't let them tame you." It's Isadora Duncan, and which means do your art and do it the way you want to do it, and don't let anyone dictate your art, because you need to continue what you started in Israel. The fact that you moved a country doesn't mean that you're going to do a different cinema. So for me, and I promised that to my actors and myself, I wanted to do authentic, real, raw, message-driven and politically and socially charged movie. That's what I grew up on, and that's what I wanted to do. And I did everything in my power with the support of my amazing producers to bring real and raw cinema. I hope I did it. I hope, you know, I succeeded doing it. But it was important for me to go through this process.
You know what, you've blown my mind when you mentioned the short time scale of making this film and the budget, because it doesn't seem like that on screen. You've done something so excellent here. It's brilliant. I can't believe that. That's awesome.
Well, thanks, mate. I appreciate it.
What I'd love to know as well is that when a film like this comes along and, you know, someone like A24 gets involved, what's the conversations around marketing this film and making sure it gets to the right people, and people that, as you mentioned, sort of that maybe there's that 15-year-old that needs to be, this message needs to get to right now. What's the kind of conversations around marketing this film?
Well, look, it's not an easy film to market, especially now. You know, yeah, the films about Vietnam were made 10 years after Vietnam War. So all the, you know, Coming Home and Deer Hunter and all those very critical film about, you know, it took a while to digest the war, and until filmmakers started making films about the war. Here, Skin is in the middle of chaos. It's in the middle. Look what, you know, you just said, look what happened yesterday. It's still going on. I don't see that vanishing at all. I just see it becoming worse. But I think Skin, and my wife told me this sentence, which is very smart, is a long-term movie. I don't think it's kind of a movie that will, you know, attract immediate audience, and it's a hard movie to swallow. It's a long-term movie, and it will be relevant, unfortunately, even 7 years from now. So that's why I think that A24 would very wisely thought that, you know, they wanted it to be online and in cinemas at the same time. And that's why we are on DirecTV in many, many, many millions of Americans, because, you know, it's If you have a chance to go to the cinema, you are thinking twice if you want to see a very heavy movie, a very dark movie like that, or you want to see Spider-Man. You know what I mean? It's not an easy movie for Americans to digest. It's basically picking the wound that America suffers from today. And this movie is basically a mirror in front of our face saying, hey, this is us. This is you. Why don't you start talking about it? Why don't you start, you know, it's not easy. But we know it's not easy, and I never wanted to do an easy movie. But this movie was sold to 55 countries around the world. It's going to have its UK premiere and going to get, you know, we're going to screen it to BAFTA members. And Jamie Bell is getting a lot of attraction for his performance. So I hope that it will find its audience around the world, not only in the States, and Jamie Bell will get the attention that he deserves.
Absolutely. And what was it like when, I'm thinking when you said earlier on that, you know, producers, investors didn't want to touch this movie, and then someone like A24 comes along and says, hey, we want to distribute your film. What was their pitch to you on why you should go with them, and what was it like for you to go, you know, a few years ago, people didn't want to touch my film, and now the people behind things like Moonlight, Lady Bird, so many other great films, Midsommar, want to take on my film. What was that like?
Oh my God, A24 is a dream. It's like being with a A club, you know, with all these amazing films. First of all, it's I was beyond. Happy and it was it happened one day or the day of the screening of Skin at TIFF at Toronto. It was the day or the night after or something like that. It was very, very close, and we had another two offers, and we chose A24. A24 is basically I adore every movie that they make and they buy and that they do. They're just such a quality tastemakers, and they have the guts and the vision to take movies that are not easy at all. But, you know, they are fighting for good cinema to be out there, and it's not easy. So I give them a lot of respect, and I will be always grateful for them to choose Skin, because they had other options. You know, Toronto was full of amazing movies, and I was flattered, and I still am, and I want to keep doing movies that they buy. You know what I mean?
So there we go. Thank you very much once again to Guy for joining us. Had you seen the short film that this was based on, Dallas?
No, I haven't seen the short film. I'm going to watch it now after I've seen it. I didn't want it to impact my viewing on it, even though, you know, that one's a documentary and this one's slightly fictionalized take on it. I still didn't want to have it influence. I didn't want to know where the story was going to go, if you know what I mean, before.
Well, it is interesting. So there is a kind of documentary that kicks around about this film, but the short film itself was a fictional story, but it wasn't about Brian Wilder. It was very much focused on the tattoos. So it's a very interesting, I don't want to spoil it because, you know, maybe we can come back, you know, this can fill a little slot in A24-hour news in a couple of weeks, but the short film has one of the most surprising, disturbed, or quite innovative twist endings, or very stupid endings. It seems to really split audiences from kind of the reactions I've read. So I'll be curious to maybe check in with you in a couple of weeks to see your reaction to the short. It is not what you would expect if you were like me, watched Skin and then dived into Skin, the short film. But it seems to be an interesting way that we'll obviously kind of touch on that in our next film as well, of making a short film, showing it can be a success, and then kind of following up into the feature film. It's kind of good to know that's still a gateway to making feature films.
You've got me intrigued now. It's not like some haunted tattoo horror film or something like that, which I do believe there is one. I did see a trailer once for a film about some guy who got a tattoo, but it was like basically some sort of, it was related to a devil or something, and it basically possessed him or something. It was like really, it looked totally terrible, but in a completely cheesy way. But I'm assuming it's probably not that. But I mean, you've got me intrigued now. I'm going to hunt it down. Is it on YouTube?
Or it will be available on all good kind of streaming platforms and stuff, as these things tend to do. I would like a text response from you, and a tweet response from anyone that has never seen Skin the Short to, you know, tweet in their thoughts on what you think of the surprising twist ending to the short, that which you can watch that short and not be spoiled if you want to watch the feature of Skin. So I'm curious, that obviously I watched it a year ago, and obviously there was this discourse. How did you feel kind of watching a film about a white skinhead be reformed, and an insight into that kind of world and antics that would go on within it, while we're obviously in the middle of sort of the Black Lives Movement? There's protests, there's, you know, we saw at the weekend protesters down in London, across America, you know, defending statues, pissing on graves, you know, all manner of horrible kind of things, and obviously with all the police violence. How did the film sit with you right now?
It was it was interesting to watch it, given that everything's going on just now. It's, you know, sort of watching it, I basically watched it at the same time as Spike Lee sort of The Five Bloods, and you know, you can't help but sort of think of some of like his previous film, The Black Klansman, as well, which, you know, Spike Lee does this great thing of being able to tell a narrative sort of fiction story, but then allows elements of true life to fit in. I mean, that sort of hard cut from Black Klansman to the Charlottesville riots and stuff like that was just inspired, and just, it shows just how little we've come along. And this film kind of sort of does the same in, it's just, you watch it and it's like we're no further forward in sort of our tolerance of other people and stuff like that. And it wasn't until I sort of got to the end of it and figured out that, you know, these were based on real people, that I'd actually realised I'd kind of seen the black activist who sort of works with these sort of skinheads to reform them and give them a new life. I'm pretty sure I'd seen him in, I think it was maybe a Louis Theroux documentary or something. I'd definitely seen him sort of working it, sort of outside, sort of campaigning outside a white supremacist conference and stuff like that. I can't remember which documentary it was, but I did remember. It all sort of clicked and came together, and it shows, you know, I guess we have to be, yes, we have to condemn their actions because, you know, what they do is terrible. But at the same time, if someone wants, is actively wanting to leave that all behind and, you know, become a better person, a new person, surely, you know, we need to sort of accept that and support that and believe that people can change, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose it's challenging for us as kind of white men to, you know, we can put faith in that. And I suppose some people have seen so many people kind of be threatened to change and so on, but institutional has meant that they've kind of, some, they will see people around them going, no, you know, we'll have a mistrust and expect people will not reform. I mean, this Brian Widener guy, I mean, he sounds like he has kind of gone on and, you know, made an impact beyond sort of this, you know, advocating, helping people sort of escape it and promoting what he kind of went through. So he certainly has an interesting story, but I suppose Skin is one of those ones that ultimately depends on what type of mood you're going to be in for watching a film like this. Is this something people want to watch and sit with now? That's really for a lot of other people to decide. It's one I certainly wouldn't recommend as such to people. I think people will either meet it or not, and that's ultimately their choice. It's an interesting film to have that sort of caveat with it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is a difficult film to watch at times, absolutely. It's probably one that should get an audience. I think it tells an important story, and it does it well, you know. It doesn't maybe do it in any sort of groundbreaking or spectacular new innovative ways, but it's a solid film, and it's well acted, well presented. But it's a story that needs to be told. You know, if people are demanding change and stuff like that, then ultimately we have to accept that people are also capable of change. Again, you know, I guess we have to hope and that it's going to be the case, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So have you got any final thoughts on Skin?
Just that it's, I mean, I don't have any tattoos, but it certainly put me off ever getting any tattoos. And I mean, I think, you know, it's something where, you know, I've always had an idea that I might like a couple ones, you know, film related, but I'm like, will I ever, like, if I got a Star Wars one, but then I kind of went off Star Wars, so I'm glad I didn't. And seeing how painful it is to get them removed, yeah, I don't think there's anything that I love that much that I would want to, you know, commit to for the rest of my life.
Yeah, tattoos
apart from
be
A24 on the shoulder.
There you go. Just make sure that you don't have anything that could lead towards white supremacy or anything like that. Maybe just like look at the screenshots at the end of Skin of like, right, I better make sure I don't have sort of a swastika, I better make sure I don't have a burning cross, and you should probably be okay with that.
Yeah, always do your research for tattoos. Yeah, don't get drunk on a lad's holiday in Magaluf or something and then end up getting something in Chinese or something, which turns out to be not what you thought it was.
Absolutely. So let's move on to our second S film of the day, Cher. So Mandy, a 16-year-old girl, receives text messages from her friend about a video that has gone viral of her obviously unconscious and being taken advantage of by boys from her high school on a night she doesn't remember and attempts to figure out what happened. So Dallas, when did you first see Cher?
First saw it a couple of weeks ago. Actually, it's another one which was a first time viewing for me. I didn't know much about it at all. I think it was an HBO Max one. I think I watched it at the same time as Native Son. And I was actually very impressed by this. I really liked the format, the style in which Pippa Bianco told this story. I mean, it's another one which is actually sort of adapted from a short, which and it was really, I was really taken with the sort of mystery element of it, because I mean, this, I guess, like Skin, this is another story which is becoming increasingly sort of relevant in today's society with mobile phones. I mean, you just have to see the sort of all the protests and stuff like that about how important mobile phones can be at capturing footage, but also this film shows the downside of mobile phones and just how they can be used for abuse and stuff like that. And it's really, really sort of interesting sort of film, which is definitely going to, similar to Skin, I think it will definitely cause a lot of discussion, particularly on the final sequence. And I'm interested to hear your views on that anyway.
Yeah, so I actually caught this also first time as a double bill with Native Son sort of in January. So, oh, yeah, I like this film, but I almost think it makes a sort of interesting feature with sort of eighth grade. Obviously, it's high schoolers, but with something like eighth grade, for example, you know, it felt like eighth grade, no matter what, you know, age you are, whether you're a 33-year-old man or you are a 16-year-old high school girl or anything, it was kind of that universally relatable kind of film about sort of the anxiety, fitting in, self-doubt, you know, trying to become a real person, I guess. With something like this, I always kind of think about it as well of like, you know, I remember getting a mobile phone in my last year at high school, you know, just a basic phone that could send some text messages. That was about it. And that was pretty, pretty incredible at the time. But, you know, with a film like this, it's a slightly different generational and perhaps gender differences that, you know, I watched that film and I can't imagine what it must be like for high schoolers these days, not just with sort of like, you know, videos like this, but also with issues where, you know, the bullying that goes on it, you know, the sexualization that these things sort of go. I mean, I'm not saying our generation was any much better, but there wasn't a device like this that seems to kind of push things from kind of 0 to 10 in terms of, you know, some of the issues we see young people facing. And I thought it was interesting to see that sort of darker world of you know, of Cher in terms of mobile technology. I mean, it doesn't necessarily say anything new, but it was quite shocking to watch. And I thought it had a really strong central performance from Rihanna Barreto in the role. So yeah, it was a very interesting film, but one that I was kind of happy I couldn't relate to, but I was able to sort of get a bit of an insight into what it must be like for a young girl, whether it's America-based or UK-based. You know, these stories are all too common in the press and media these days.
Yeah, no, I mean, this... I think I got my first mobile phone when I was at university, and it was one of those phones where you could only, like, text up to about 40 or 50 characters or something like that. I think it was probably several years after that before we even got camera phones or video phones. I mean, if I were to take a photographic or video memory at a party, it would have been on like a 35 millimeter camera that you would then have to send to Boots for the film to develop, and it'd be like a week, and then it would be those little stickers on for quality control because your thumb's been over the lens and you can't make anything out. You know, people don't look at that. See, that's the kids, so they don't get that the sort of risk and danger, the sort of expectation of having to wait a week to find out what the photos look like. Now it's just instantaneous, and I guess that is part of the problem. But I mean, remember watching films and like when the mobile phone first came in, I think it was like Scream was probably one of the first sort of films which showed what you could do with a mobile phone in terms of the killer is no longer in the house. They could be anywhere in the house. And yeah, I think mobile phones have always been an agent of evil almost in a lot of films. But I think I get what you're saying about the eighth grade comparisons, because you can sort of put all the social media stuff to one side and it still has the relatability of it's that general sort of thing that everyone's gone through, is just trying to fit in at school and stuff like that, and the worries that deals with. I mean, the technology thing, I'm so glad that I didn't have to live through that and whatever. And I'd probably be sort of more in line with the sort of parents in this film, of just being sort of completely shocked and not really knowing how to handle this and what to do. And I mean, I think it's interesting that the device that they use, and that she wakes up, you know, with having been completely drunk and having no memory of it. So the audience are in the same boat as her in trying to sort of figure out exactly what/if anything actually happened. Because that's a point she doesn't know at the beginning. There's a video of, you know, her sort of passed out drunk in the toilet, and sort of there's a guy sort of, you know, pulling up her trousers or whatever, but they could have fallen down because she would passed out drunk in the toilet. We just don't know. And it's interesting to, it's almost got this sort of mystery, sort of almost whodunit sort of element to it. She tries to piece together, sort of in a memento style, I guess, sort of working back through her memories and stuff and speaking to different people and trying to build a picture together of what actually happened that night. I thought it was an interesting structure and a way to go down around the story, I thought.
Yeah, I like that too. Obviously, this film is also based on a short from the writer-director, Pippa Bianco. I thought that was also interesting because the short itself is only maybe kind of, I think it's like 11 minutes, maybe a bit less, and it's quite a relatively kind of straightforward story. Whereas this, it plays more sort of with the noir elements. I suppose it kind of beefs up it to sort of a feature-length film. So I thought that was quite an interesting approach, and I think, you know, where it certainly draws out a lot of the themes. And I think this is the type of film where I think there could be a reason for us to be maybe shown in schools, for example. You know, the line that stuck out for me was when the mum is having the conversation with Mandy, and she's like, you know, explaining that her husband and men in their lives will never understand how common this kind of thing has always been. So while we're obviously seeing here, you know, oh God, I'm so glad I didn't have mobile phones and wasn't some, you know, this wasn't perhaps much of an issue then, there was something always perhaps potentially going on, whether we were aware of it or not, and you know, whether we, you know, more of these issues are still kind of brought up these days in terms of it. There's a light that's shone on it, but there's still so many cases that go unspoken, that justice doesn't happen. And, you know, I thought that was an interesting line. You know, it was so great that you have a female writer director here that is able to kind of infuse that script with perhaps her own experiences, good, positive, and her takes on the world. And, you know, while we're perhaps not the people that are sort of going to be able to nod and go, yep, I can relate to that, we can sort of go, oh, you know, it maybe makes us think a little bit and kind of reflect on how calm this has actually always been.
You know, I think it's, I mean, you can tell immediately that, yeah, this is definitely the work of a female writer, director. You know, it's all handled very delicately and in the right way, in that there's never any sort of blame placed on the lead character for her decisions. Yes, she gets into trouble, but the trouble is for, you know, going out and drinking and stuff like that. You know, there's, it's interesting, you know, the parents never blame her for what's happened, and I think that's good. The parents are actually really sort of well-drawn characters. You know, the dad at some points is clearly a bit lost and feels a bit like a failure because he's failed to protect his daughter from, you know, men who, you know, more often than not are just complete swear words. But then the mother is also very sort of compassionate and stuff like that. But it's interesting that from the school element, it's almost like this is, and this is where I think a lot of it comes from, is this institutionalization of, you know, how one person's thing can affect the entire school image, and therefore, you know, she's kicked off the basketball team, and it's not because of what's going on, it's because she was found to be drinking at a party, so therefore we can't have her on the team. But it's trying a way to sort of hush up and sort of, you know, the school doesn't want to be involved in any of this because it will open themselves up to a wider acknowledgement of a problem which is probably far too commonplace, that, and it really shouldn't be. And I think a lot of, like you say, it's something that definitely probably could be put in schools, because I think there needs to be a lot more education about sort of uses of social media and the effects of that, but also, again, just, I mean, sex education. I mean, back when we did sex ed at school, it was like living and growing, and it was like they would wheel in a TV and a VCR on a stand, and it would be, everyone would sort of like snigger and stuff like that. But I think the world has moved on so much in terms of the consumption of sort of pornography and stuff like that. I mean, back in the day, I think it would be, you'd be lucky if like someone's older brother would buy a magazine. I think that was basically your only sort of access to that, or, because I mean, there wasn't really, you get some probably dodgy VHS shops, but there wasn't like Victoria's Secrets or Ann Summers or anything like that. It was very hard probably to get access to that, whereas this point, it's, you know, it's just on your phone, and therefore it's almost like the parents and the schools and stuff like that, they're basically swimming against the current and are struggling to be able to, it's an unwinnable battle. And it's like, how do you educate kids and stuff like that in order to be proper and respect and stuff like that? It's just, it's not something that I don't have the answers, and I don't have kids, so I don't have to worry about that yet. Maybe things will have changed by the time I do and I have to have that kind of conversation, but yeah, it's just something which I don't envy parents these days having to work out how to talk to the kids about all the stuff.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's certainly an interesting kind of double bill on the face of it, where we ultimately, there comes away with social messages that kind of reflect our times for, in quite a, you know, a negative and tough way. And, you know, I think it's interesting that they'll provoke lots of different discussions and reactions from people probably watching it at home, which is always a positive. It's not just always about entertainment and coming away. Sometimes it's about those conversations we have around the TV, and, you know, boy, we certainly have the time now to watch a film and then have conversations afterwards. So hopefully people will, you know, check out Skin and Share for the first time and go on and have those type of discussions with families, sons, daughters, about race and gender.
Yeah, and not to give the game away, I don't spoil it, because this is definitely one of those films which is probably rather underseen, and a lot of people will probably be, if they're going through the project, they'll be coming into it anew, but so no spoilers. But to have that kind of discussion with you, I'm just interested to know what you made of the finale of the film, because I can understand, I guess, the decisions that are made, but it's the kind of ending which made me really mad, and I want to throw my phone across the room after watching, because I had to watch it on my phone, because that's what I had the HBO app on. So but yeah, it really sort of angered me and frustrated me, but then I guess maybe that was the point.
I think there's an element that's the point, but I think, you know, without playing it away. I think that's probably what happens most of the time, to be honest. I mean, a lot of these sexual assaults, you know, revenge porn, all these sorts of things, a lot of it just goes unreported. It, you know, it's, people are aware of it, you know, in terms of the school, nearly every single person knew there. You know, justice is so hard to come by, and victims like Mandy are very rarely served by the kind of people that are there to protect them. And, you know, you can see these things sometimes go to court, the accusations that are leveled at people. Ultimately, I suspect Mandy would have just been the story of 1 week, and then the following week there would have been a video about someone else, and then the week after that. You know, I don't agree with or disagree with what Mandy did. I just think that was probably the realistic and option, and that's the saddest one. I think the easiest option probably for the film would have been to sort of maybe see justice come to fruition. In the reality, I think we saw here is what happens day to day, and that's maybe the saddest thing.
Yeah. Yes, that is the case, but yeah, I can understand the point, but yeah, it doesn't make you any less mad at that.
So. Nah. So, any final thoughts on Cher?
Just that, yeah, it's one of those ones which you probably haven't heard of, but I think both of these films are ones which are definitely worthy of being on the A24 sort of catalogue. Again, they are, as A24 are very good at, is sort of finding different audiences and different types of films to target. Obviously, I mean, I don't think they're actively going for the white supremacist market with Skin, maybe the anti-white supremacist market, but I think it's, they are very good at showcasing all different sides of life and cultures, race, sexualities and stuff like that. So I think it's, they're definitely worthy of being on the A24 calendar. And excited to see where we go next from here as well.
Yeah, so we go into a very different direction with The Death of Dick Long next and Low Tide. So I'm looking forward to discussing them with you in 2 weeks' time. And next week we'll have an interview dropping with 8th Grade's Jake Ryan. So that's one to look forward to too. So thanks very much to everyone for listening, and stay safe out there and take care. Bye.